I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. In this episode, I talk to renowned developmental psychologist Paul Bloom. Bloom is the author of a bunch of books, but his most recent one is called The Sweet Spot: The Pleasures of Suffering and the Search for Meaning. Paul and I go way back to my grad school days at Yale when he was one of my mentors. We always have a great chat, and this one is no different. In this episode, we cover a lot of territory. We discuss the value of suffering in pursuit of meaning and make the distinction between unforeseen tragedy and chosen suffering. Paul elaborates on BDSM and horror as examples of benign masochism, activities that people find comfort and enjoyment in despite the experience of pain. We also touch on the topics of meditation, Buddhism, attachment, parenting, empathy, and rational compassion. This is a very juicy episode, and I hope you enjoy it just as much as I did. So without further ado, I bring you Paul Bloom. Dr. Bloom, it is so great to chat with you today on the Psychology Podcast.
It's nice to see you again, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. I was coming up with The Sweet Spot by Memory. That is the title of the book, right?
That is exactly the title of the book, The Sweet Spot.
Now, great, great. Now, you had a prior title, which is one that I was working with in my own head while you were writing it. I thought it was going to be called The Pleasure of Suffering or something along those lines. Is that right? Was that your working title?
Yeah, you have a good memory. We had a conversation just a while ago. It was originally going to be called The Pleasures of Suffering. And it was originally going to be about that, about what Paul Rozin calls benign masochism, why we get pleasure from pain, from BDSM, from hot baths, from cutting ourselves, from, you know, your mileage may vary, but why that kind of activity gives us pleasure. And I got into the book doing a lot of that. And then I became more interested in the idea that suffering could yield other things like purpose and meaning, issues that I know you're very interested in.
Oh, yeah.
And so the book expanded. And so it ended up as The Sweet Spot.
Cool. Well, why did, and I'm very curious about this, thought it'd be a good place to start. Why did Daniel Gilbert almost persuade you to not write this book?
So Daniel Gilbert, I know you know him. He's a psychologist at Harvard, one of the nicest and one of the smartest people in the business. And Dan is a hedonist. Dan will tell you that he believes that in the end, all that we're after is pleasure. And my book is very much against that. My book could be seen as an argument against hedonism, arguing that, you know, yeah, we do seek out pleasure. We like to scratch where it itches, but we also seek out purpose and meaning and other longer term goals. And Dan just kept pushing me on this. You know, whenever I said, you know, to Dan, well, you know, certainly people choose to suffer. They choose to sacrifice for higher goals. Dan's response was always, yeah, because they like it. They like it more than an alternative. And it turns out to be hard to argue against that. So a good chunk of the book, particularly in the end, is sort of taking on Dan and talking about his views.
You really did. You really did. You even got to the point where you're like, look, not to beat a dead horse here, but I feel like it's important that I tackle this. I feel like you even like, you know, broke the third wall a second there at one point in the book. And you're like, look, I know I've gone on 3 pages about this and it might seem excessive, but this is really important. And I agree. I mean, it is important, this difference of opinion. You know, he has this view of, you know, this additive model, right? We kind of add it all up at the end of our lives and we're on our deathbed. We're like, okay, I've had 47,000 positive experiences. I've had 24,000 shitty experiences. It's been a good life. And then you die.
Yeah.
But your argument, so maybe the additive model is not the right way to think about this in your book. It's not. So let's dive into some of the ideas in your book and present your views now. You know, so first of all, I want to ask, what is the potential value of suffering?
So there's several answers to that question. The basic one answer, which everybody agrees on, is sometimes you have to suffer to get what you want. So, you know, if you have a baby, you might wake up in the middle of the night to feed the baby. You might not enjoy that, but you just do it because you have to. You might have a painful vaccine shot because you don't want to get COVID. You take the 8:15 into the city. You do work because you need money to survive. That's the obvious answer. My book explores 2 less obvious answers. One is suffering could be a source of pleasure. So sometimes, like, we choose to watch movies that scare the pants off of us, that make us cry. We choose to engage in activities like, you know, martial arts or endurance training or whatever that just exhaust us and hurt us. And we love it. It gives us a certain sort of pleasure. And then I think maybe most significantly, so we are creatures that pursue meaning, like extended purposeful activities that often have significant ends. And you don't get that without suffering. So in this second case, it's not suffering per se that we're after. We're after what I'd call meaning, but suffering is a necessary part of the package.
Yeah, it's not something that just comes along for the package. You're saying it's actually an essential part of the package. And that's an interesting distinction, an important distinction. You really, if we can double click here for a second, you're talking about chosen suffering.
Exactly.
And chosen suffering, this is another very important distinction, chosen suffering versus unchosen suffering. Now, I work a little bit in the field of post-traumatic growth. In fact, my next book is on post-traumatic growth.
Really?
Yes, believe it or not.
Do you have a title?
Yes, the title is called Choose Growth. At least that's nice. The working title. You know, that we have some choice, you know, in our arsenal. About whether or not we can make that decision versus make a different decision. So this is very interesting. And this I think we should talk.
we should talk.
Like right now.
We should talk.
Right
yeah.
now. Let's good, have a conversation
yes.
about this, because you kind of take on that field of post-traumatic growth and make it clear that's not what you're talking about. So first of all, I would like your own voice to speak here. So can you tell a little bit about why your book is not a book about post-traumatic growth? It's a book about chosen suffering, and I think it's an important distinction.
Right. My book is fundamentally about what people want. And take a step back. It's about why we so often choose to suffer in the sort of examples we're talking about. And it explores different reasons for it. And the main story it tells is that we're it defends motivational pluralism, meaning we want different things. And for many of the things, suffering is essential to getting them. For pleasure, for morality, for meaning. If you're not experiencing suffering in your life, you probably are not satisfying the goals you should as a person. But this is chosen suffering. Mm-hmm. There's another claim, which is that unchosen suffering, the bad stuff that happens to you, in some way can add value to your life, can make you more altruistic, can make you more resilient, can in some way make you better. And I'm skeptical about that. I'm not skeptical, and maybe here we're just going to sketch out an agreement. I'm not skeptical that there's different ways to respond to bad stuff that happens, to having your house burned down, your child dying, being raped, that there's ways to deal with this. And some ways are better than others. I also can understand that in some cases, some bad stuff could happen to you and you could end up getting better as a result. It just can't happen that way. The world is strange. But for the most part, I would argue that I've been accused of making unintuitive claims in my career. Here's an intuitive one, which is bad things that happen to you should be avoided. Avoid unchosen suffering if you can. Do we disagree on this?
No, we don't disagree on this. And as you even say in one of your paragraphs, you said, look, I don't even need it seems ridiculous to even put footnotes, yes. citations saying rape is bad.
Yes.
I thought that was clever. I mean, you're right. You know, there's some things you don't need to in order for it to be true, you know, you have to include scientific study that shows, you know, that to be the case. Yeah. So yeah, we're definitely in agreement on that. I would say that you mischaracterized the main thesis of the post-traumatic growth literature, however. And at least certainly the way that I'm presenting it in my new book next year, essentially, we are not making the case that suffering, the event itself, is good, or the event itself is what is the catalyst for growth. But we make the case that it is the cognitive restructuring of the event. It is the extent to which the event causes us to fundamentally change our worldview, like a seismic earthquake, but a psychological mm-hmm. earthquake. It is the meaning that we gather from the event. So in that sense, I think we're actually quite aligned in from the meaning perspective of it. And also think we're quite aligned in the sense that you talk about the word suffering as applying to a wide range of events, not just ones we stereotypically think of as suffering, but anything that's kind of challenging our worldview and shakes us up in a significant way. And well, that's exactly how the post-traumatic growth literature mm-hmm. thinks about suffering as well. So I think there's more aligned there than not. I think that you probably, as I do, have this certain bone in your body where I think you enjoy actually saying things that are anti-establishment standard, you know, like you wrote a book called Against Empathy, but then when you actually get into the details, you're like, okay, that's pretty reasonable. You know, you look at the title Against Empathy and you're like, oh, but then you read your book and I found it quite reasonable. Okay, rational compassion, you know, don't always rely on the gut. You know, sometimes it can lead us astray. Yeah, no, these are good points. So I think that you had a lot of good points there. I would just push back a little from the strong claim that there was one sentence, I think, in your book where you say something like post-traumatic growth, that's all ridiculous, or that's not right. But I think that when you actually get into the details of the thesis of the post-traumatic growth literature, some researchers, including me, are trying to be very careful to say that it's not the event itself. It really is to what extent can that event create meaning.
But let me, you've been very fair in sort of sketching out my views. Let me make a distinction, which I think we could agree with. And then let me ask you a question. So the distinction is actually really nicely made by C.S. Lewis. So C.S. Lewis talks about fasting, and he compares it to you ran out of food. You go 3 days without any food because there's no food, and you wish there was food, there's no food. And he says, you know, they're both forms of suffering. But fasting is a way of, it can be wonderful, could be a way of exercising your will. It's by choice. Running out of food is just something awful and happens to you and doesn't carry the same sort of psychological implications. So let's now go back to, something terrible happens, death of a child, say. Worst thing I could imagine, death of a child. Yeah. And are you saying, I don't doubt that death of a child can lead to definitely leads to psychological changes. Can under some circumstances lead to psychological changes that in some cases person could say I'm better off? But are you saying that if you had 100 people whose child died and 100 people who didn't, there's a sense in which the first 100 are better than the second 100?
No. We're saying given that it happened, how does one move on from there in a way where they can grow as opposed to have post-traumatic stress, become depressed, say life's over. I think that's the important thing. And that goes right back to Viktor Frankl, who you quote,
voluminously.
What did he say? Sorry.
I quote him voluminously.
Yeah, you sure do.
My subtitle, part of the subtitle, Search for Meaning, is a shout out.
To
him.
So the points he made as well. You know, it's not, you know, I'm not claiming that 100 people who went through the Holocaust It was better for them than if they didn't go through the Holocaust. I can give you a quote from Rabbi Harold Kirshner, who is reflecting on the death of his son, and I think he put it quite well. He said, "I am a more sensitive person, a more effective pastor, a more sympathetic counselor because of Aaron's life and death than I would ever have been without it. And I would give up all those gains in a second if I could have my son back. If I could choose, I would forego all of the spiritual growth and depth which has come my way because of our experiences. But I cannot choose." And I think that's just what I try to emphasize. Yeah.
So I'm going to be hard-boiled here. The second half of the quote, I totally agree with. Nobody would choose that. If it gave me superpowers and made me empathic and made me wonderful, no way would I want this terrible thing to happen. It's the first sentence that I want to push back. Is it really true, on average, for most people, that we do end up more sensitive, compassionate, etc., after something terrible happens to us? It seems to me like an empirical question about how the mind works. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure. Yeah. Are you? Do you think he's right? I mean, you can't. And you know, somebody says to you, you know, I got cancer, and now I'm much more. My life has much more meaning. I'm much kinder. I'm more resilient. And it's simply bad manners to disagree. But are they right? I could point to a lot of people who these terrible things happen, and they get worse and not better.
I've been on the search for the perfect mattress for the past few years, and let me tell you, I've gone through so many mattresses. My friends have made fun of me because for so long I didn't actually own a mattress. I just went through so many free trials. I had no idea what it feels like to be well rested until I tried a Helix mattress. Are you not able to sleep because of stress and anxiety? It's definitely understandable given the current state of the world. Psychological research shows that high quality sleep is so important for stress and well-being though. Lack of quality sleep can affect your memory, increase mood swings, and even can lead to depression. While a number of factors contribute to poor sleep quality, your choice of mattress can really matter a lot. Helix Sleep makes personalized mattresses right here in America and ships them straight to your door with free, no-contact delivery, free returns, and a 100-night sleep trial. To choose a mattress, Helix made a quiz that takes just 2 minutes to complete and matches your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress for you. If you like a mattress that's really soft or firm, you sleep on your side or your back or your stomach, or you sleep really hot, with Helix, there's a specific mattress for each and everyone's unique taste. Personally, I took the quiz, and I was matched with the Helix Sunset Luxe because I wanted something that felt soft, and I sleep mostly on my side all night. I've got to say, I love my Helix mattress. I wake up really feeling refreshed and ready to work out or start my work. Also, I've been tracking my sleep with a device, and my sleep score is consistently in the good or excellent range. This is a new thing for me, so it's really exciting to finally get high-quality sleep. I really do love Helix, but you don't have to take my word for it. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ, Wired Magazine, and Apartment Therapy. Just go to helixsleep.com/psychology, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it, but you probably will. Right now, Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/psychology. Get up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows at helixsleep.com/psychology. That's helixsleep.com/psychology.
You know, you make a good point. Well, unfortunately, we don't have a control group within a person. And there's not a lot of terribly great systematic studies on the topic that have a control group, even in a group of people who've undergone such a thing. So that you make a good point in your book about that. I do think that there are ways in which, because of the way the event was processed, because of the meaning that was made from it, that there was growth. Perhaps we should, maybe we should just stop there as opposed to make the claim. Sure. It's better than if they didn't have the event. And I think that's what you're pushing back on. And I think that's fair because there are just not enough good studies with that control group. So maybe the best scientist, you know, when I talk about, I still think the field of post-traumatic growth is important because I think that it emphasizes the fact that these kinds of ways of processing challenging events in our lives, which we're less likely to do with positive events. When there are wonderfully positive events, you don't really care much about the meaning of it. You're like, I'll take it.
Yes, yes.
That's right. When someone, you know, gives me $1 million, I'm not like, let me journal about this. Let me spend that money.
Yes. I have to reassess how I'm living my life now. No, I don't really. I'm doing well.
Right. So I think that, you know, let's sort of meet together and say, I think the value of that post-traumatic growth literature and the reason why I'm writing, you know, devoting so much of my own personal time to writing a book about it is because I think, you know, we couldn't choose to have had COVID. Now, it's an open empirical question. Do we have shown any growth during COVID that we wouldn't have shown if there wasn't COVID? But this, I can say, during COVID, so many of us did reprioritize things in a way we probably would not. I really think we probably would not have if there wasn't COVID. We were going along, you know, without that violation of our expectations. And I think there's something interesting that happens psychologically when our violations about our assumptions, you know, the assumptive world theory, where our assumptions of the world are really shaken up. But there are a lot of things that can cause that kind of shaking up process, including some of the chosen suffering you talk about in your book, right?
And you know, there's a riff we could take on this, which is, I think we might both again agree on, which is when bad things happen, people want to find meaning in them. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have a chapter in my book on religion and on the idea that everything happens for a reason. And, you know, sometimes I'm tempted to the view that one of the reasons we have religion at all is that we see it as having a promise of answering the question, you know, why, where does this suffering come from? And giving us an answer that's ennobling and positive. As an atheist, I think it's all nonsense. But nonetheless, you know, the question, wanting to find meaning in the suffering, my child died, why? And to hear the answer, it's all for the best, is extremely powerful and extremely seductive.
Extremely powerful. And a lot of people who like lost their children to school shootings, for instance, then become strong advocates of against gun violence, right? And so would they have been as ardent anti-gun violence? Would they have gone out there and trying to change other people's lives and change the whole system as ardently if they didn't lose their son? Probably not. Would they prefer that their son died because it made them ardent supporters? No. I mean, that'd be ridiculous to make that claim.
Yes, of course.
But, you know, this is why humans are complex.
But you're choosing a case where a tragedy motivates people to work for a cause that I think you and I would believe in. You know, we could both easily think of cases where tragedy pushes people towards other causes. A lot of people who choose lives of violence and hatred do so in response to some tragedy in their life.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, it's certainly true. And well, this is also just a fascinating question about the development of trauma and individual differences in the way it manifests itself in adulthood, you know, when there was childhood trauma. I'm very interested in that question, very fascinated with that, because you do see people going down different paths with the same exact experiences. Right, some people have had experiences where they're sexually molested, and then they grow up and they sexually molest others. Some were sexually molested; they grow up becoming really strong, you know, activists against sexual violence. You know, what causes that difference between the two, and then what are the moderating variables? What are the individual differences in societal variables? I mean, it's fascinating. It's such an important question, and I would never claim to have the answers to all of it.
But you might by the time your book comes out.
Maybe by the time
I could be your Dan Gilbert, just kind of nudging you. And then ultimately you address me and you just kind of move on.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, there's something within you as well where you took Daniel's points and you said you were almost persuaded, but you didn't. You obviously went ahead with your own thesis in the book. There was a certain confidence, self-confidence you had in your own particular thesis, which, what is that individual differences variable? What is it within you you know, I mean, maybe you've been around the block long enough where you're like, I earned the right to have self-confidence in my own theories and ideas and the research that you amassed. But maybe someone else would have listened to Dan Gilbert. Do you see what I'm doing? I'm mapping on my point to asking you directly, yeah. Why do you go in one direction versus the other? You know, someone else may have listened to the great Dan Gilbert and be like, you're right. I wasted the last 3 years of my life working on this, you know, but
well,
you didn't
come to that conclusion. Nobody should ever give up a theory. Just because there's a good knockdown argument against it. Because there's a good knockdown argument against anything. Any proposal you could come up with, some smart person, I could give you 10 reasons why it's wrong. And so in the end, we sometimes have to go with the weight of the evidence. We have to say, I can't explain away that. I can't answer that question. I'm just gonna plug ahead. And fortunately, you know, you're right, your book, and someone else write a book saying the opposite thing. And then, you know, the world will be richer as a result.
I love that attitude. And I also love the idea of you being my Dan Gilbert. Is it okay if we send you a draft of our intro?
I would love it.
Tear it to pieces. No, and then that process will cause me to have growth.
we'll both grow as a result.
That's meta growth. That's meta, yes. Post-traumatic growth. Yes. You know, yeah. That's meta when you're writing a book about it.
And then there's another debate lurking behind all of this, which is, mm-hmm. I know you you talked to Paige Harden recently.
I did, yes.
And actually you more than most, I think you're very sophisticated about the extent to which heredity plays some degree of, in determining what we are. And there's sort of a real complex dance between heredity and environment. And we're sort of at a stage where somebody says, well, you know, early childhood events have a profound effect on personality. We can say, well, you know, it seems that way. That's what Freud taught us. That's what most people believe. It's just not clear.
It does get tricky when you talk about genetics. That's, like what happens when you make that claim and you see the empirical evidence for it, but then you control for genes and the effect goes away. It's in those cases where it's like, holy cow, what do we do with that finding? And a lot of people don't want to talk about some of those kind of findings, like in criminology field and sociology. They would rather you never even control for genetics because it's like, and we don't want to know. But that does raise some interesting questions, as Paige and I discussed, in terms of what are the implications for helping vulnerable people? You know, what are the implications there for making the world a better place, as opposed to just talking about those findings, as some people do, in a kind of almost a mean-spirited way? Do you know what I mean, Paul? Some people might raise the point of genes and be like, well, look, just deal with the truth. I'm capital T truth. Parents don't matter. And it's like, well, look, there's more to the story than just that. They matter it in a way that is might be a little bit different, but they still matter. They gave you their genes. That kind of matters.
If you want to blame your parents, you have plenty of room to do so.
Right. I mean, they still are to blame for that.
Yes.
They brought you into the world. You could always be like, why did you bring me into this shitty world?
But, they are causally responsible for our existence. And what's a more weighty act?
Right. And also the way that and the actions they do onto you do matter in various ways as well. In terms of the formation of your personality.
I've always felt that the discussion on that has always been a little bit weird. There's a point that people like Judith Harris and Steve Pinker make repeatedly, and it always seems to be very true, which is some people can read into the genetic stuff, the idea, oh, parents don't matter. So, and then they say, either happily or derisively, does this mean it doesn't matter how I treat my kids? But you as a parent have enormous responsibility for the happiness and flourishing of your kid. A cruel parent could make a kid's life hell, and a wonderful parent could make their kid's life as good as it could possibly be. And even if this doesn't end up fixing their IQ in some direction or another, or personality, it's still an enormous responsibility. In some way, it's like saying, if you tell me, look, how I treat my partner won't change her personality, and then I respond, so I could treat her horribly, you'd say, this is ridiculous. You treat her kindly because you love her. You want her to be happy.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more with that. It does get tricky because someone could say, well, yes, I love the spirit of what you're saying. However, I can show you data showing that whether they treated you horribly or good doesn't officially change their longitudinal Big Five score.
That's right.
And you almost, I almost want to respond sometimes like, okay, like, okay, Mr. Robot, let's have a, you know, human point of discussion, which is like, maybe it didn't budge the Big Five too much, but you know, there is still a moral implication of making someone's life a living hell. Exactly. Like that still matters. Do you see what I'm saying?
Exactly. You know, no sane parent, you know, takes their kid for a really fun day doing something the kid loves to do. And then says, well, I'm doing this because this will change the kid's personality. If it doesn't, screw
Big
him.
Big Five. I want to budge their,
I want to budge the Big Five. Score. Yeah. Yeah. I want to lower neuroticism. You know, and I think sometimes we actually, part of the problem is we forget children are people and that, you know, and that some of our moral obligations to them are the same as with people. They're not necessarily projects or things to be molded.
Yeah. We're in complete agreement
yes.
on that.
Yes.
Just returning to some of the ideas in your very interesting new book, you'd argue there are multiple independent drives that normal humans possess. So we already talked a little bit about the hedonic drive Daniel Gilbert espouses so much. There are moral drives, as you talk about in your book, and then there's meaning and purpose. Let me add one. Can I add one?
You can add one. I think I know what you're going to say, but go for it.
I'm going to say it and then tell me if this is what you thought I was going to say. I think the exploration drive is a unique drive that contributes to what researchers are calling the psychologically rich life, which has been distinguished in recent years from the pleasure end meaning,
yes.
and I would say morality as well. So if I could add a candidate one to the list, it would be the psychologically rich life. And is that the one
It's related. It's okay. I like that. There's a recent paper by I think Oishi and Westgate.
Correct.
Right?
That's the one I'm referring to.
Yes. And I think the paper opens up this other alternative. And I think that that's true. I think that I think it was Mike Norton who talked about emo diversity, which is you know we want to have a diversity of feelings. And then there's just broadly you want to explore. Yeah, I definitely think so. I think
that's that the one you thought I was going to say.
Yeah. I would have guessed some version actually more of self-actualizing and personal growth. Mm-hmm. Was that one? Would that be one you'd put on your list as an independent one, or do you think it falls from the others?
It falls from the others, I think.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, I would say that self-actualization is really bringing your whole self to the table in a really integrative sort of way.
Yes.
I would actually make the case that self-actualization is the real harmonious integration of all those multiple independent drives that you talk about in your book. That would be the emergent property of the deep integration of that in your life in a way where neither one is so outsized, where you're not a pure hedonist, but you're also not a pure meaningist.
Yes. Yes.
I invented that word.
I think that's clever. I think it's clever. There's probably some, we're not just a set of motivations or a set of drives. There's some probably integrative principle that we want to sort of pull things together and put things in balance. I'll also say that it's going to be a fairly long list. So you and I are just saying pleasure, hedonism. But the drive for sex and the drive for food and the drive for status and the drive to be loved are just different things. They're different parameters. You could see them. You can imagine them on a dial where some people, you know, have very little sex drive, but are enormously concerned about status. Some people don't care for physical comfort, but you know, love food and so on. So I think the true story of human motivation is going to involve a lot of different things.
Absolutely. And Abraham Maslow would agree with you. Scott Barry Kaufman agrees with you too. But but Abraham Maslow had this very interesting idea. He called it a hierarchy of pleasures. And he actually had the concept meta-hedonism. And so his idea of meta-hedonism is that there's actually a hierarchy of pleasures all the way up to the fact that altruism can be pleasurable. So we make this kind of false distinction, he argued, between pleasure and meaning, because a lot of things that bring us meaning in life actually bring us pleasure. So this is he had this whole hierarchy of hedonism. I thought you might get a kick out of that concept of meta hedonism, higher pleasures versus sex, you know, like just raw sex is a lower pleasure. Maybe like sex integrated with love is a higher pleasure. And we higher levels of integration, you have higher levels of hedonism. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I mean, even Jeremy Bentham, who's often parodied as a sort of simple-minded hedonism, saying we just want what feels good, had a taxonomy of pleasures, including ones like the pleasure of a good name, is what we call now status, the pleasure of mastery, which is something I'm very interested in. Mm-hmm. And so you know, there's ways to put sophisticated glosses on hedonism, even if ultimately we end up saying that there's something more. We don't want to quickly deride it.
Agreed. Okay, now I really want to jump into this idea of benign masochism and this phrase you use in your book, pleasurable pain. Really like this phrase, and maybe we could start by jumping to the deep end and discussing BDSM. Because you defend BDSM as the reflection of normal appetites. That's how you put it.
I do.
So I was wondering if you could do the same defense live on, well, not live, it'll be recorded, but if you could do the same defense on my podcast right now.
It's funny where a career takes you, where now I'm talking to you and now I'm doing a defense of BDSM.
This is life choices.
Yes. And first we'll do something which, as you well know, benign masochism is a term not mine. It's thought up by the great psychologist Paul Rozin, who's done some lovely work on it. So my interest in the book isn't so much to defend or attack certain practices, but sort of to explain them. But I will defend BDSM from the very start, even before we get into what it's about and why people do it, by saying that the studies have been done, and if BDSM was the expression of pathology, of something gone wrong, you'd expect it to come along with other mental illnesses. People who do it would be depressed or anxious or schizophrenic or failures at life or high in bad traits. And it does not seem to be true. The people who partake in BDSM seem to be psychologically healthy in other ways. So whatever, if you have a moral objection to this sort of consensual act, that's one thing. But to simply dismiss it as, you know, like Freud did, to say this is just expression of madness, is wrong.
Yeah.
But why do we do it? And the best theory I've come across on this is from Roy Baumeister, who's written a lot about it.
I love Roy Baumeister.
Roy Baumeister is one of the most creative minds in our field.
Agreed. He's also your friend.
You have good taste in friends. He's a smart, creative guy. And he talks about it in terms of escape from self, which sounds like a kind of weird, kind of crunchy, maybe mildly bullshitty term. But the idea is that ourselves weigh upon us, our the voices of ourselves, and how am I looking physically? You're looking at me. Am I looking okay? I'm talking, is my voice okay? I'm thinking about things I've done in the past. And just as you become sick of somebody else, you become sick of yourself and want to escape it. And meditative practices are one attempt to do so, drugs are one attempt, but BDSM, where it's the sort of controlled, chosen experience of pain and maybe humiliation, is arguably a way to escape from yourself. And so that's the case for it. That's what it might give you. If you're obsessed with status and obsessed with how you appear, I mean, pain does this. Forget about BDSM, simple pain. If you think of experiences where you experience sudden pain, you slammed a car door on yourself, you stepped on a nail, you know, there's a lot of negative things to be said about this. But one positive thing is, while that was happening, you weren't thinking about anything else.
It's true.
And so certain forms of, you know, exercise, martial arts, do this. For me, and I'm curious what you have to say, for me, actually, meditation is the opposite. So I'm very frustrated with meditation because I always want to escape from myself, and meditation involves the way I do it as a total novice, locking myself in a room and being stuck with myself?
Well, I would defend meditation practice a little bit and say that when I do it in a way where I can really divorce myself from my thoughts, I really do feel like it's an escape from myself. It's hard to get to that point, just like you talk about flow and why flow is so hard to get to. It's one of those things, I would say it's analogous to the point you make about flow in your book, is that, well, I love flow and I love being in a certain meditative state, but it takes a lot to get there. Whereas immediate pain might get me there quicker.
I think that's right. I think that I know enough people who are good at meditation. It sounds like you
it
are.
It sounds sort like of a whipping sound in the background there, yes, Paul.
It's my chair. I don't have somebody whip me to capture my attention.
I heard a whipping sound.
I think it's just your imagination, your powerful imagination. I did read a news story once about a guy, some sort of CEO type, spent too much time on Facebook and hired this person to stand next to him and slap him in the face whenever he went on Facebook. Wow. And then I would imagine the story would go on that they would fall in love because of all the adrenaline and everything.
It could be. The point here, the nuance here seems to be picking something that is less painful than what you're currently experiencing, but is painful enough that gets your attention away from it. It seems like, you know, if we like put this into a math equation, because last night I was reading your book, I was finishing it last night, and I had a splitting headache, and I went and I took a really, really hot shower that felt so good, and it made me forget my headache. But the hot shower, you know, it stung a little bit. It was hot. It was really hot. But it wasn't as bad as the headache. I imagine that if I went into a scalding hot shower, you know, that gave me third degree burns, I wouldn't be like, oh gosh, I'm so much more happy I did that than the headache, than just focusing on the headache. Right?
Yeah.
Is there some truth to what I'm saying?
Yes. So nobody should do that and then sue me for giving like false advice. Yeah. So one explanation for benign masochism we just talked about was escape from self. Mm-hmm. But there's a more general thing going on involving a sort of calculus of pain and pleasure. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes what we do is we seek out pain, typically not intense pain, but pain nonetheless, like hot curry or a hot bath or something like that, saunas, rigorous exercise. Because when it is relieved, there's a jolt of pleasure. And sometimes your jolt of pleasure is enough so that it compensates for the pain.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of weird. It's like this old joke my father told me about the guy banging his head against a lamppost, and you ask him why he's doing it, because it feels so good when I stop. But weirdly enough, I think one ingredient of benign masochism is you experience pain under controlled conditions. You feel a mastery while you're doing it, but also it feels so good when you stop.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to come back to the contrast.
That's right.
And the thesis of your whole book about the sweet spot, and why you decided to write your book more about the sweet spot than what you were going to write about before, which was just the pleasure of suffering. So this all is real consistent. I like when that happens. I like when it happens.
Right. And you know, think about along these lines certain entertainments, like like certain movies, which are, you know, the typical arc of a revenge film is terrible things happen. You know, they kill John Wick's dog. It's very sad. And then there's the satisfying vengeance at the end. And you'd be asking the wrong question if you said, wouldn't John Wick be a better movie and revenge films if you took away the first half? But you can't have the second half of the first half. You can't have the satisfaction of seeing revenge being unleashed unless you have the sort of horrible stuff at the beginning. You can't have the satisfaction at the end of the little engine that could, or the little engine really succeeds, if you didn't have the struggles in the first half. And I talk this data scientist did this big analysis of stories. And basically, it took like 100,000 stories, plots of stories. And basically, the answer is, you know, things get worse and worse, and then they get better. And that's sort of a typical story arc.
You know, just to also defend meditation a little bit as well, there a big part of that is being able to witness non-judgmentally that arc. You know, you through a whole meditation session, you can witness, you know, the catastrophizing of the brain, the stabilizing of the brain, you know, then the catastrophizing again, and then oh well, there's a moment of peace, and what you do is you try not to get attached to any one of it. Well, that's very Buddhist of me to say this. But
that's extremely Buddhist. I mean, I'll take controversial positions all day, but I'm not going to argue against meditation. Sure. It's sacred. But certainly you wouldn't want to be in that sort of Buddhist state, you know, while watching Rocky.
Hmm.
You don't want to be detached from it. You want to dive in.
Great point. Great point. And you make this point in your book as well, where you even rethink rational compassion a little bit. I liked that you did that. You know, there was this one paragraph where you're talking about, you know, jumping in fully into the stream of love, into the stream of connection. And you said, well, maybe I need to rethink some of my own ideas in against empathy. So can you talk about some of that a little bit? Do you remember that?
No, this is interesting. I mean, it's people read things in your books that I didn't intend to be overt about. So tell me more. So tell me more. So in Against Empathy, I argue that our gut feelings, whatever of empathy, whatever their other benefits, are poor moral guides, and we're better off with rational compassion. And you're saying I repudiate this at one point.
Yeah, you said maybe that's not the complete story.
Yeah. Well, I know I talk at one point about children, about having children and relationships.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder whether that's it. What I do talk about...
I'm not Google search. I'll search within your book.
Search within my book. My last book was Mistaken.
You said, my last book was called Against Empathy, and I argued there that emotions such as empathy are too biased and enumerate and parochial to be good moral guides. We're better off when making important decisions with a more distant approach, what I call rational compassion. And I drew upon Buddhist ideas to make this argument. In this regard, my book was quite aligned with Buddhist philosophy. But in this book, I also wrestled with challenges to my view. And one of these was the issue of close relationships. Rational compassion seems antithetical to being a loving partner, friend, or romantic partner. You're not supposed to be distant and unbiased towards those you love. What I just appreciated about that section of your book is that you wrestled with some of these criticisms. And I thought that was admirable. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you. I mean, just to say what the objection is, and I've had discussions with people. I have so many friends who meditate, like Robert Wright and Sam Harris, and I had the same discussion in different forms of each one of them, convincing neither one, which is that it is antithetical to certain things. It's there's this old joke about, you ever hear about the Buddhist vacuum cleaner? It comes with no attachments.
I love that. I've never heard that.
So I don't even remember where I got it from. But
I'm totally tweeting that one.
Yeah, that's good. I do not want to fight with the meditators. But the idea is that I think a good morality is objective, detached, impartial. It is wrong for me to, and I go out in the world, favor people who look like me and favor people who are close and so on. But the exception is family, and it's complicated there. And I do wrestle with this in my Against Empathy book, and I'm still wrestling with it, honestly, which is that...
But I can remind you that you're wrestling with it.
No, I mean, I think a good leader, a good politician, in many ways, is fair and objective. But a good father or mother isn't fair or good. They're partial. They're partial to their friends. They're partial to their children, to those close to them. I would favor my child infinitely more than over a stranger. And I don't think that that's mistaken. And I also don't think that the Buddhist model of detachment fits well with parental love, our romantic love, or sexual love. I mean, what do you think? You probably have thought of this more than I have.
Well, I've seen some data because I originally thought that it seemed incompatible. I thought, for instance, attachment theory, like insecure attachment would be, or secure attachment would be almost the opposite of non-attachment in the Buddhist way of thinking. But I looked at studies that actually attempted to operationalize both constructs and showed that that secure attachment is very, very strongly correlated with non-attachment ideas in Buddhism. So non-attachment Buddhism is actually very, very aligned with secure attachment in the literature on attachment theory, which they argue is most secure attachment is very conducive to mental health and healthy relationships and strong connections. I think perhaps you're mischaracterizing the idea of non-attachment in Buddhism. I think that Zen Buddhists, if they were on the show right now, would say it doesn't mean we don't fully feel the emotions, or we don't really appreciate the value of those experiences. But there's almost a bittersweetness to them, where we recognize the impermanence of them in such a way that we don't get so identity attached to them. But is that any different than what you're saying?
To some extent, recognizing the impermanence of things doesn't seem to be in any way in tension mm-hmm. with love and relationships.
Right.
But other things might. One of the things which you had actually mentioned before when we're talking about movies is seeing things as they really are, sort of stripped from our preconceptions and our biases and so on. But I don't think a good father sees his son or daughter as they really are. They see them in a way that's sort of clouded by their love and their favoritism and their affection, not as they would see anybody else.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I think that in that case, having your vision clouded is a good thing. I don't think there's anything, you know, the people who love me, I imagine, see me in a way that favors me. There's psychological claims we can make at a level of perception. Do they literally see me differently? And there's debate about that. But certainly at some level, it's an old psychological finding that we think the people we love look better than anybody else does. They just look more attractive because, you know, Shakespeare would have told you this too, but it seems to have data for it. I'm not sure that's a bad thing.
Maybe it's not a bad thing in general. I could see instances where it could be a bad thing. A topic I've really become interested in lately, and I'm writing an article about right now, is group narcissism. There's an extent to which when we identify someone as part of us, you know, it could be in a love relationship, could be in terms of a club identity ideology, we're more likely to overlook moral transgressions in the other person that we wouldn't overlook with someone where we didn't feel that way towards them. So I could see that being a potential case of it not being so good.
That's really interesting. I agree. I could imagine it. I could see that causing all sorts of damage. Even for my closest friends, I don't think I'd want to overlook their moral transgressions.
Right.
Overlooking implies a sort of stupidity and obliviousness to them. Yeah. But I imagine I would want to think of their moral transgressions differently than if they were strangers. I mean,
really?
If you don't treat your friend or think of your friend differently than a stranger, what makes them a friend?
Yeah. What even is a friend anymore?
Exactly.
Well, that's a great question. It's a great question. I don't have a precise definition of a friend, and it seems to intuitively to me, it's, you know, there's an element there that seems key, which is, are they there for you in times of need?
Right.
Are you there for them in times of need? Is there some a part of a support system? Yeah.
And all of that demands bias. If your friend is there for you when you need her, then that means she's not available for everyone else who comes to her. You're on the top of her list.
And well, this is really
if she treats you like everybody else, then maybe again it hits a sort of Buddhist ideal or a sort of rational compassion, impartiality ideal, but you've lost a friendship.
Super interesting. Yeah, because it adds further nuance to your book, Against Empathy. It almost begs for an extra subtitle, you know, or no, asterisk, you know, Against Empathy. Overall, in a lot of cases, but look, don't take my book so seriously where you never have biased empathy towards someone else, because sometimes that can actually be some of the most beautiful experiences on earth.
Well, to that extent, so Against Empathy was always about moral choices. And I never doubted, and here I guess I'm not very impartial, I'm not very Buddhist, I've never doubted the importance of partiality. It's where I sort of, in some way, part company with the consequentialists, with the utilitarians, who say we should live our life, you know, as if all pleasure and all pain are of equal currency. But I don't think you can have a moral code that asks people to do something they simply cannot do. And ignoring the ties of family and friendship is, as mammals, as primates, as creatures of our culture and society, we cannot do that. It's asking too much.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it at the group level, because you on the one hand make a great point in your book about how empathy can lead us astray, and make us have hate for an out-group when we say, you know, we have so much love for our in-group. And I think that's a great point. But then we're kind of saying there's another hand here, which is that you can have this beautiful empathy. It doesn't have to lead to out-group hate, you know? It can just lead to more intense and, you know, love for a friend, for a family member, for, you know, for others that you identify as part of yourself in some way, your identity.
And there's a big difference between loving yourself more and hating others.
Agreed.
But it's still, in a sense, zero sum, which is, suppose somebody says, it's not that I hate black people. I really don't. I just like white people more. Mm. There is a difference. That really is a difference. But still, it means that this individual, in either case, when choosing between one group or another, would choose the group that they belong to.
Fascinating. Is it zero sum? Is every bias in one direction zero sum? I don't think so. Yeah.
Well, it's not zero sum.
It's not like someone else loses in every case, just because you're preferentially treating one particular, making one decision.
Suppose in your classes you prefer to spend time with the male students than the female students. Just you feel more of an affinity. It reminds you of yourself and so on. Wouldn't you see in this case that the female students lose something, even if you have no animus towards them?
Look, that is a good point. But I'm saying, you know, I'm saying I don't think this applies to all cases. So let me give you a case. So it's not like when I choose the love of my life to marry, you know, I guess in one sense, a narcissist sense, I can be like, all the ladies have lost.
You are depriving. But they have.
That's not just a narcissistic point. That's actually a good point. You're saying that it's not just a narcissistic, cheeky comedian kind of stand-up routine, but you're saying actually it is zero sum because all those ladies have lost out on the great Scott Barry Kaufman.
No, I accept your point. I accept your point, which is either if the resources are abundant, like, or they aren't in demand, you don't have to have a zero sum situation. Suppose I love my son the best I love everybody in the world, and I devote all my resources towards him, but I'm not in a position to help anybody else anyway. So nobody loses. It's just that in the real world, often there is this trade-off. Let me ask you about this article. The group narcissism seems fascinating. Are you against group pride? Pride's sort of a gentler word than narcissism.
I'm not. And I almost don't want to give too much of a spoiler alert to this article, which should be coming out in the Atlantic soon, because I wanted to make a big splash.
Fair enough. I won't. But
absolutely not. I go through great pains to distinguish between healthy group love, healthy in-group love versus collective narcissism, which I see as very unhealthy and even detrimental to the goals of the group itself. In the same way that an individual narcissist makes lots of decisions that are actually in the long run detrimental to their own rational goals. In a lot of ways, it's irrational, a lot of the decisions they make in the name of greater ego protection.
I so much want to pursue this, but I also respect your desire to hold off and make a splash with this.
Well, thank you. That's exciting. And suggests that that a lot of people might be interested by this article. I can't wait to share it with you.
I'm sure it's going to cause a lot of interest.
Yeah, I hope so. Let's talk about imagination, the human imagination. This could kind of be our last topic today. I'm really interested in why we suffer in our imagination. What is the value of suffering in our imagination? And you take this up in a way that is actually a continuation of discussions me and you had over a decade ago in the round table room. In the round table room, I remember exactly where I was sitting. I can picture it so vividly in my head. You standing up there, pacing around, being like, "What is the value of horror?" And do you remember our discussions about this?
I remember the room. I remember you being there. I forget exactly how that went back and forth. So remind me.
Well, no, you just had these weekly lab meetings that I was a part of, and these were issues that were on your mind then.
And when you were there, just starting to wrestle with them. I was 2006. Just starting to wrestle. It's a while ago.
I mean, it's a long time ago, but I was equally as captivated then and fascinated by these questions as I am now. So it's so cool that there's continuity of interest in trying to figure out this puzzle.
I've always been interested in these questions. I've always been interested in the question of why are our imaginations populated with such horrors, such sadnesses? And, you know, we're talking about horror movies and tragedies, but also, you know, Dan Gilbert, who we talked about before, has a lovely study of Matt Killingworth, which looks at what people daydream about. And people's daydreams are often sad.
Yeah.
Other studies on what people dream about. Most dreams aren't so good. They're slightly below the midpoint and everything.
Yeah.
And so it's such a rife topic. And I explored different explanations, some which we touched upon before about the rhythms of a story. One theory which I think is deserves to be taken very seriously is the idea that we're drawn towards negative things in imagination as a form of sort of perhaps an evolved propensity to deal with them, to prepare ourselves for them. You know, I can't help my mind wandering to the worst cases, because if I think about it, maybe I'm better prepared if they were to happen to me in real life. To go back to your example, it's fun to fantasize about winning a great prize or a great sum of money, but you don't have to steal yourself. All you have to do is say thank you. It's just great. But to think about the world going to hell, which is a common theme in horror movies and zombie movies, is something we dwell on. And I think we dwell on it because it's useful to sort of think about it and prepare. It's a case for what we want to do and what we want to think about isn't necessarily what's pleasant to do or pleasant to think about.
For sure. How do you explain there's individual differences? You know, some people, they have found certain personality traits are attracted more to horror than other personality traits. You know, people who are thrill seekers, for instance, love that. They love haunted houses. There are personality traits that have to do with haunted houses as well. So the people who really don't like that stuff, do they suffer in their imagination in other ways? Or is there a general individual differences variable here of a propensity towards enjoying suffering and imagination, and there are others that don't enjoy suffering and imagination as much? I'm just curious from an individual differences perspective. Is that a fair question?
I think it's a great question. I think one answer is the one you gave, which is we do know that sensation seeking of a sort correlates with different forms of desire for imaginative suffering. And we do know that there are age effects that I think having to do with the fact that you don't want to take imagination too seriously. You have to sort of insulate yourself against it. It's very pleasant for me reading a Stephen King novel about a small town with an axe murderer, but I don't want an axe murderer in my own town. And if I can't keep them apart too much, I'll have trouble. But I'll answer your big question, which is, as best I know, nobody knows the answer to that question. I certainly don't. I don't know why some people like spicy foods and others don't. I don't know why some people like BDSM and others don't. I don't like know why some people like tragedies and like to cry. Others like sad songs. Others like horror movies. There are not the sex differences you would expect. There are not. It's a puzzle. It's a puzzle. In my experience, if I stand up in front of an audience and I say, describe masochistic pleasures and ask for a show of hands, does anybody have at least one of them? All the hands will go up. Mm-hmm. But it'll be very different. There are some people who cannot bear to see a horror movie. There are other people who love spicy foods. And it's just, it's a mystery. And I know you've done a lot of great work on personality differences and how and how the traditional measures of personality predicting. Do you have a prediction where we could look?
Oh, well, I think that the sensation-seeking domain is very, very relevant here. And I also think that there people really do differ in their threshold for pain. And you know, you just even discussed this in terms of self-injuring. A lot of people who self-injure say they don't even really feel it too much, and there could be a lot of reasons for that. But but a lot of people would feel it, you know, whereas they don't tend to feel it. Though you know, there's a different. Go on.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, and as you pointed out, there's a debate over whether people who injure themselves who don't feel it, whether that's they choose to injure themselves because they're the people less likely to feel pain from it, or whether this is because of their engaging in a practice. One thing we do know, it used to be thought that a solution to why people like horror movies or disgusting movies is they just aren't as scared or disgusted. And it turns out it's not true. People who love scary movies are just as scared as people who hate them. They just enjoy the fear.
They enjoy it.
Yeah.
And enjoy. And you know, what does it mean to enjoy? Well, it, to a certain degree, it means that they tolerate it. They can tolerate it more than others to a certain degree where they're able to, what, fill in the blank. They're able to, what is the pleasure part of it? They're able to overcome the struggle, maybe. Maybe the pleasure is in the overcoming a challenge, knowing that there's something that maybe other people couldn't even handle, and yet they can handle it.
You know? Could be so the joy.
I really want to unpack that.
And it could be the joy of mastery. That could be part of it. But it could also be, and in some way here, I've been influenced by some emotion researchers, including Lisa Feldman Barrett, who I disagree with in other ways, but I think has a sophisticated take on emotions. We might have to give up the idea that fear is bad. So we tend to think fear is aversive. Who wants to be afraid? But I think what's bad is the things that frighten us. If a rabid dog was chasing me, I'd be very frightened, and it's a bad experience. But the badness comes from the worry about being bitten by the dog, not the fear itself. If you could have the fear stripped of the danger, as in a horror movie or a haunted house or fantasy, that could be a lot of fun. Same with anger.
Absolutely. Not only a lot of fun, but I'll kind of end this interview today with your point about transcendence. You know, not just for hedonistic reasons, but for transcendent reasons as well. You know, you say in your book, you say, I'm the least spiritual person on earth, but but even I can, you say this in your book, but even I can say that there's a lot of immense value to transcendent experiences.
Yeah.
And as you point out in your book, a lot of these things are not only done for hedonistic reasons, but they're, you know, we make sacrifices because there's this a more like awe, the feeling of wonder, the feeling of transcending ourself in some way that can carry on after our mere mortality, right, is a beautiful reason sometimes in and of itself, even above and beyond the hedonistic reasons.
That's nice, very nicely put. I think that is a good place to end.
So, Paul, it is always such a delight chatting with you. I feel like I can always chat with you like all day long. And this has been over a 15-year intellectual love affair. I don't know how else to put it. Intellectual love affair.
I feel the same. And I hope this makes it and it isn't cut out at the end of the, when people need to cut things out. But I really appreciate the very careful and very thoughtful read of my book and connecting it with other works. It's unusual, and you push me in places, and this has been really a delight.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.